I have loved this book. Or can you hear me now? Good. I have loved this book, every page of it. I hope the rest of you have too. I'm sorry. I'm kind of sorry. This is the last day, but how wonderful the chapter 9 was and is. And I'm so happy that Juliet is with us today. Before I introduce Juliet, I would like to read a prayer from John Philip Newell's book from this chapter, because I think it was so moving. Awake, O my soul, to the prayer of dawn that is within you. Listen to its hopes for a new day. Follow its intimations of fresh light. You are an explorer of what has never been before. Awake, O my soul, to the prayer of dawn that is within you. Awake, O my soul. I'm very honored to be able to introduce Juliet today. Juliet's been involved with La Casa de Maria for many years, and that's where I first met her. And I was just telling her the other day that I think La Casa is kind of our local Iona. It feels like that to me. Juliet began delving into Celtic spirituality in the 1990s when she studied with Matthew Fox at the Institute for Culture and Creation Spirituality. After joining the staff at La Casa, she continued her interest in Celtic spirituality with teachers such as Richard Groves through the Anamkara program in Dublin, as well as John Philip Newell. And she took a pilgrimage to Iona, Scotland. She believes that the teachings of this tradition speak to our current need and offer us hope today. Juliet attended the Immaculate Heart High School in Los Angeles, where she began her journey with the Immaculate Heart Sisters. In the days before feminism, this was when she learned what a gift it was to be born a woman. 40 years later, she became a member of the Immaculate Heart community. She worked at La Casa de Maria for 14 years in the early 2000s. And before that, she had worked for peace and social justice issues for 2 decades with the Quakers in San Francisco. Later, with the Council of Churches in the early 90s, focusing on racial justice and immigrants' rights, and then with the Franciscans on social justice and advocacy issues for St. Anthony Foundation, where 2,000 meals were served every day. Juliet has 3 sons and 6 grandchildren. So welcome, Juliet. And now we'll ask Christine to do our blessing for Juliet.
We bless you as you share your gifts of spirit, light, and insight. We welcome you with joy.
Thank you so much. Thanks to Tim and Judith and Anna and Christine. What a wonderful team and what a wonderful gathering. You provide such enrichment for all of us. And yes, Tim, what a wonderful day that we're ending on St. Patrick's Day. That is just so exciting. So what we're going to delve into a little bit more today is this theme of sacred journey, journeying with John Philip as he brings Kenneth White to us. So in terms of sacred journey, I want to begin with a bit of sacred journey to Iona. I know last week you all had looked at MacLeod and some of his work there. And so I want to bring to you some images from Iona and a little bit about grounding in the ancient history there And then move into talking about Kenneth White as a Scotus Vagrans, a wandering Scot, much as John Philip Newell is a wandering Scot today. So I'm going to share with you some images from Iona. I have been blessed to be a pilgrim on Iona and with John Philip many years ago, and so I'm able to bring some of these images. So I want to begin as Kenneth White's early poems was very much about the mythopoetic and early Celtic tradition, pre-Christian as well as Christian. And so Iona comes into focus with St. Columba in a kingdom that was called Dalradia, that actually Catherine Collis first told me about when I was headed for Iona. You can see that the kingdom was kind of like Greece was, a western coast of one country and an eastern coast of the other. So with Ireland down here, embracing the west coast of Scotland and the islands of the Hebrides, remembering that the Hebrides means the islands of Bride or Brid, who was the Celtic goddess in pre-Christian time, obviously also related to Bridget. And over the centuries, their stories and images have come together and traditions melded myth and history together. Here's another image from a topographical map. So Columba began down here in Ireland, and there are different stories about how Columba actually got to Iona. If you listen to the Irish story, Columba was visiting a sister monastery in Ireland for a period of time. And while he was there, he copied one of the manuscripts that monastery owned. And then he brought it back to his own monastery. And for that, he was highly censured and in fact in exile. So maybe it's the first example of copyright infringement that we have. So let's approach Iona. One comes by land, by sea, by ferries, by multiple means to get to this little island. Barely 3 miles long and 1 mile wide, it looks back to the mainland of Scotland, to the islands in between, to Mull. And it was over this sea that Columba set out from Ireland with his 12 monks. So think 12 apostles, right? And came to this liminal place of the Celts. Iona has some of the most ancient stone on our Mother Earth. It's called the Lewisian gneiss stone. It's a pre-Cambrian metamorphic stone. And here are some samples of it, with its beautiful colors and the beautiful nature that fills the island. So I invite you to enter into this liminal space. The first monks had little round cells that they lived in apart, because Columba was part of that Celtic hermetic monastic system that really came from the desert fathers and mothers in Egypt. The early monks were these Kalidei, the Kaldi, and here is a contemporary Kalidei, Fionn Tulach, that many of you may remember from having studied with her when she came to Lhasa. On the island, as on many Celtic sites, both in Ireland and in Scotland, is the Celtic cross, bringing together the horizontal and vertical lines of Christ's cross and the circle in the middle for the encompassing cosmos in which we live. Ruins abound on the island. And one of the earliest buildings, much restored on the right here, is Oran's Chapel, possibly dating back from Columba. We know that he built one. And then in the distance, the newer buildings that MacLeod and the Iona community built, where John Philip Newell and Ali Newell were co-wardens for many years. This is the sea on which the boats from Scotland would have brought the bodies of the kings of Scotland to be buried on the island, including Duncan and Macbeth and Robert the Bruce. This is a ruin of a later Benedictine monastery after the Council of Whitby had let go of Columba's original settings. And the cloister in the current monastic setting. And nature still abounds. Iona is a place of pilgrimage. It's also a place of peregrinatio, of wandering, of walking to find one's place of resurrection. Some interpret that as the place where one will die and enter into the other world. Others speak of it as the place where one finds one's soul. So now I want to move into the peregrination of Columbanus or Columban. So in the generation after Columba, these incredible monks set out from Ireland and Scotland and came onto the mainland of Europe. Many of you may remember the wonderful book that came out in the 80s or 90s of how the Irish saved Western civilization. Well, this is where it began. It began with these monks, with those manuscripts, either written originally in their monastery or stolen copyright from other monasteries, bringing those manuscripts into Europe, across France, and settling along the Rhine and creating Celtic monastic settlings along the Rhine into Switzerland here, founding St. Gall, one of the great monastic settlements, and finally ending up here in Italy with Bobbio, where Columba died. And here's our Columban with his book, Bringing Civilization to Europe. Now, we don't know exactly what part of the Celtic tradition came down and lasted after Rome took over those settlements, but there is certainly a resonance with Hildegard of Bingen, who was on that Rhine Valley where those monks came with their teaching, And we also believe that there's a resonance with the Franciscan tradition. We know that St. Francis, centuries later, went to Bobbio when he was first deciding to build his own community. So let me just stop sharing there at this moment. And let me move into Kenneth White. So as I mentioned earlier, Kenneth was very much a Scotus vagrans. Born and raised in Glasgow, as you read, and attending university there, but then early at university time in graduate school, moving to France, and then essentially staying in France and wandering around France for many years, buying a farm to leave the civilization that he no longer felt connected to, and ending up in Brittany as well. As you know, that White's early works were very much focused on and influenced by Celtic spirituality, going back to pre-Christian Celtic mythology, as well as the early Christian Celtic myths and traditions and practices. As we read his poems, we can hear reflections from the Carmina Gedelica that we had read earlier in our book. His poetry, as John Philip reminds us, looks for the shining that is deep in all things. He calls it the Diamond Country. And John Philip notes, and I think it's important for us in our modern era, I mean, Kenneth White is a contemporary, he's just a few years older than myself, that this is different than Yeats's romantic kind of Celtic twilight, Celtic revival. This is something that has a broader metaphysical and epistemologic emphasis, as well as the cultural emphasis. Like Columban, White himself, beyond his travels to France, was deeply influenced by the philosophy of Heidegger and the phenomenologists, but he wanted to reach beyond the European tradition to see if there was something more universal that he could bring in to this understanding of the natural world and the deep shining that lived within it. And so White visited Asia wondering and thinking if there might be some affinities with his Celtic base that far into the East. And in that, began to study Taoism and Buddhism and began to bring those Eastern thoughts and understandings of nature and of the sacred back into his writings. Later, he visited the Pacific Islands, the Caribbean, North America, always seeking resonance beyond histories and individual cultures to a greater whole that the earth had to offer us. For White, civilization had become a dance macabre, as he said, because civilization was a refusal of the earth, and it had warped the ground of existence. He said, "We are survivors of a great catastrophe, the industrialized world. It has made us remote from nature, and we are paying a price. Even our religions have called us away from nature." How very tragic, and certainly in the post-Celtic Christian world, that was true of our Christian religion. He, as a poet living in a post-Hiroshima world, he saw humanity in exile. Exile from country, exile from the idea of God, exile from ourselves. He said, "Humans are standing at the edge of the world, But rather than remaining in the existential crisis that surrounded him, certainly in academic Paris, where he continued to teach among his fellow professors there at the Sorbonne, he attempted to return us to nature, to our origins, the sea, the earth, matter, and mater. He believed that we needed to decenter from the human, from the world. So think today when we are in this moment of racial reckoning and we're talking about decentering us as white persons so that persons of color can move into the center and be observed. He was asking, shall we decenter? Do we need to decenter humans for a while so that the earth can speak, so that we can listen more deeply? His was a quest for a unitive experience of nature. He said, I want the one and the many to be no longer separate. I do not want myself to be separate from the world. I want to feel all the connections, yet still be myself. A challenge I think perhaps we all share. He uses wonderful poetic words like wonder standing, fields of in being. I want to feel all the connections. I want to enter the flow of light that is within all things. From a poem of his, Ars Poetica, he writes, this holy of holy rock, this barnacle crowned and rack encumbered, ridged and rift, worn and weathered stone, is an altar whereon I, man and poet, make abrupt communion with the virgin world. White, as a poet and intellectual, created a whole new field of studies, which he called geopoetics. It's referred to briefly in our chapter. It sees the natural world as sacred text, but he takes it further and he actually creates a movement, the Institute of Geopoetics. And I looked it up and there are centers throughout continental Europe and on the British Isles and as far away as New Zealand. He wanted it to be a movement of outward moving poetry that would include an inquiry into ecology, culture, science, and existence to begin again from the ground up, as Heidegger had proposed to him so many years ago. White wrote, at one point in my itinerary, after long years of research in history and comparative culture, I began to ask myself, beyond all religions, ideology, moral, psychological differences that exist in our world and that sometimes create havoc in it, is there one thing in the North, in the South, in the East, in the West that we could agree upon? And he said, I came to the conclusion that it could only be the earth itself, that strange and beautiful planet, apparently rare in all of galactic space, on which we all try, and mostly rather badly, to live. Let me come back to share my screen to read. one more of his writings. So, sorry, let me show you a couple while we're journeying with him, a couple of pictures. Here's a young Kenneth White, probably in the 60s. And here's a more mature Kenneth White. And then here's what he said. This is the summit of contemplation, and no art can touch it. Blue, so blue, the far out archipelago, and the sea shimmering, shimmering. No art can touch it. The mind can only try to become attuned to it, to become quiet and space itself out, to become open and still, unworlded knowing itself in the Diamond Country, in the ultimate unlettered light. As I was seeking to find more about Kenneth White, I came across, it's very hard to find his books, and but I came across the fact that he had written a book of essays on the work of one of our California poets, Robinson Jeffers, whose home that he built out of stone is just down the road a piece from my family's home in Carmel. And in fact, the week that our world closed down because of COVID, I was just finishing up my training to be a docent at Jeffers' home. Kenneth White was always fascinated with coasts and shores, and he wrote one book called On the Atlantic Shore. And shortly after that followed the book that he wrote on Jeffers called The Coast Opposite Humanity. So a generation before White, Jeffers was an influential and highly regarded prophetic poet. Rejecting his Calvinist Presbyterian father's faith, he turned to a kind of pantheism, and his philosophy of inhumanism has great resonance with White's notion of decentering the human. Jeffers believed that transcending conflict and ecological destruction required human concerns to be de-emphasized in favor of the boundless whole. And not without surprise, here is the replica of a Scottish-Irish tower that Robinson Jeffers built out of stone with his own hands, right on the edge of our coast, our Pacific coast. I don't know whether Kenneth White ever managed to come there and to see it, but you can see the Pacific behind there. So this is what Jeffers wrote. Nature knows that people are a tide that swells and in time will ebb, and all their works dissolve. As for us, we must uncenter our minds from ourselves. We must unhumanize our views a little and become confident as the rock and the ocean that we are made from. And here is Jeffers' coast, our coast. I'd like to read to you one of Jeffers' poems that I think must have influenced Kenneth White, and it's called Continent's Edge. At the equinox, when the earth was veiled in a late rain, wreathed with wet poppies waiting spring, the ocean swelled for a far storm and beat its boundary. The ground swell shook the beds of granite. I, gazing at the boundaries of granite and spray, the established sea marks, felt behind me mountain and plain, the immense breadth of the continent before me, the mass and doubled stretch of water. The long migrations meet you, and it is nothing to you. You have forgotten us, Mother Ocean. You were much younger when we crawled out of the womb and lay in the sun's eye on the tide line. The tides are in our veins. We still mirror the stars. Life is your child. Mother, though my song's measure is like your surf's beats, ancient rhythm, I never learned it from you. Before there was any water, there were tides of fire. Both our tones flow from the older fountain. So, as we draw to a close on this wonderful study of Newell's Sacred Earth and Sacred Soul, I'm wondering if we might be inspired to make peregrination along our shoreline of this Pacific edge, facing this primal meeting of ocean womb of life, and at our back, the sheltering mountains of our Pacific range, the stone of Mother Earth, holding us fast. Might this be a practice to help us enter into the vast shift in consciousness that Kenneth White, John Philip Newell, Robinson Jeffers call us to? John Philip talks about Kenneth White's journey as a threefold journey. First, a journey rediscovering the earth, our deepest home, our place of deepest identity. Second, rewording the world as sacred voice, as text, a dialogue between human and nature, and a listening, a deep listening to the non-human. And finally, a journey to a new found land, a new way of being, being fields of in-being, wonder filled. And so I'd like to invite you now into conversation with one another. And I have two questions for you to talk about. And I know that Tim is going to put them in the chat as well. So my questions for your conversation are, what do you want to carry forward from our study of Celtic spirituality? How has it enlarged, enlivened your ideas about the sacred, sacred earth, sacred soil? And question two, do you have a place, a liminal place, your Iona, where you go to find earth and soul coming together? A place where you experience liminal space and time and share it with one another. Thank you.